Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
When it comes to the actions of the department, we need to be communicating with you on a regular basis, whether it's about reorganizations, policy matters, or anything else. Because ultimately, all the department does is carry out the will of Congress.
At a confirmation hearing before the Senate Ag Committee, Stephen Vaden, a former general counsel for USDA and current judge of the Court of International Trade, up for Deputy Secretary of Agriculture.
The United States Department of Agriculture has no independent authority separate of Congress. It's not established by the Constitution. It is a creature of statute. And so you have my word that we will be in constant communication, and my office in particular will be in constant communication with you about the department's initiatives.
This is Agriculture Today.
My goal this morning is to outline a blueprint to restore equilibrium to the global financial system and the institutions designed to uphold it.
Speaking recently at the Institute of International Finance, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent on the current imbalance of trade.
I have spent the bulk of my career from the outside looking in on financial policy circles. Now I am on the inside looking out. I am eager to work with each of you to restore order to the international system. To achieve this, however, we must first reconstruct the IMF and World Bank with, or reconnect the IMF and the World Bank with their founding missions. The IMF and World Bank have enduring value, but mission creep has knocked these institutions off course. We must enact key reforms to ensure the Bretton Woods institutions are serving their stakeholders, not the other way around. Bringing balance back to global finance will require clear-eyed leadership from the IMF and World Bank. This morning, I will explain how they can provide that leadership to build safer, stronger, and more prosperous economies all around the world. I wish to invite my international counterparts to join us in working toward these goals. On this point, I wish to be clear. America first does not mean America alone. To the contrary, it is a call for deeper collaboration and mutual respect among trade partners. Far from stepping back, America First seeks to expand U.S. leadership in international institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. By embracing a stronger leadership role, America First seeks to restore fairness to the international economic system. Nowhere is the imbalance I mentioned earlier more obvious than in the world of trade. That's why the United States is taking action now to rebalance global commerce. For decades, successive administrations relied on faulty assumptions that our trading partners would implement policies that would drive a balanced global economy. Instead, we face the stark reality of large and persistent U.S. deficits as a result of an unfair trading system. Intentional policy choices by other countries have hollowed out America's manufacturing sector and undermined our critical supply chains, putting our national and economic security at risk. President Trump has taken strong actions to address these imbalances and the negative impacts they have on Americans. The status quo of large and persistent imbalances is not sustainable. It is not sustainable for the United States, and ultimately, it is not sustainable for other economies. Now, I know sustainability is a popular term around here, but I'm not talking about climate change or carbon footprints. I'm talking about economic and financial stability, the kind of sustainability that raises standards of living and keeps markets afloat. International financial institutions must be singularly focused on upholding this kind of sustainability if they are to succeed in their missions.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This is kind of a convoluted slide as well, but it's my stocks to use ratio. This is days of use on hand at the end of the marketing year, measured on the axis in each case. In the U.S., we've been increasing that number. We've been below 40 for 3 years. These were pretty good corn prices in 2020, 2021, 2022. The first half of 2023 was good.
Texas A&M AgriLife Extension grain marketing economist, Dr. Mark Welch.
This year, now we've had a setback as USDA cut the yield of last year's crop. But we saw that increase in the U.S., but globally, we haven't seen that carryover increasing because the U.S. has been coming up. Now, with a smaller crop globally, a smaller crop in the U.S., that's creating an environment of significant volatility and price impact if anything has a short crop in any major producing area, with the U.S. number being down, the world number being down, we're create some opportunity. Now, if we plant 95 million acres of corn and have a good crop year, we're going to bump that purple line up for us significantly in 2025. But that creates, if you look at where these numbers are coming out of the end of last marketing year, take those back over the last 10 years. They're the lowest we've seen coming out of the drought and the prices we saw back in 2013. So globally, the world stocks-to-use ratio, our fundamentals for grain, are tight globally, a little tighter than we thought we were going to be here in the U.S. this year. Now, that may change here in 2025. Are we going to plant more corn this year? Yeah, more than likely. The prospective planting report said we would. And why? This is the price relationship between November soybeans divided by the price of corn. Kind of a rule of thumb is that if that ratio is 2.5, the soybean price to the corn price, 2.5, doesn't matter what you plant. If you're in Iowa or Illinois or Indiana, your net farm income is going to be about the same. This is what that ratio relationship has done since last October. When we set the insurance price between those two commodities, it was 2.24. We've bounced back up now the last couple of days to 2.3, 2.31. So that still could change. That could still evolve before we put seed in the ground up in the Midwest, up in the Corn Belt. But certainly that would indicate more corn acres relative to soybeans. And the question that's still unfolding is how many more? And one thing that still will influence that is what's the price do between now and the time planting is done? This is a relationship between the change in prices and the change in planted acres. And the relationship being that if the price goes up between February and April, we're going to plant more corn than we said in the prospective planting report. If the price goes down between now and April, we're going to plant fewer acres, more likely to plant fewer acres of corn than we said in the prospective planting report. So if we see prices still relatively low in April compared to where they were in February, we're probably not going to plant that 95.3 million acres. It's going to be something less than that. Yeah, if we have a strong rally in prices beyond that, then those kind of dynamics start to change. And so that's kind of the overall, kind of makes sense, right? That if prices are better and improving, we'll plant more corn. If not, we might back off a little bit. 2 points on that, though, I think are very, very important. Look at 2007 and look at 2020, the two extremes in that relationship. And if you want 2 points that just blow up my R-squared and really affect the consistency of that result otherwise, those two numbers do it. Actually, between February and April, in both of those cases, the price went down a little bit, about 50 cents a bushel, about 45 cents there, went down about 55 cents here. But look at the change in actual plantings compared to prospective plantings. We went up over 2 million, we went down 5 million. Demand-driven changes.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
At the aggregate level, Africa's economic outlook remains broadly stable under current trade policies, with real GDP growth for the continent largely unchanged, even if reciprocal tariffs are reinstated.
Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is Director General of the World Trade Organization and an economist from Nigeria.
This is because Africa's trade with the U.S. is relatively small. The share of Africa's exports to the U.S. as a percentage of its total exports to the world is about 6.5%. And the share of Africa's imports from the U.S. as a share of its total imports is also about 4.4%. Nevertheless, this masks significant variations across countries. Some countries like Lesotho are particularly vulnerable due to their high reliance on textile exports to the U.S. market. This is about these exports are about $240 million, or 10% of Lesotho's GDP. Cote d'Ivoire is another example, the largest cocoa producer in the world with about $800 million in exports to the U.S. Cocoa is a crop that is not grown in the United States. With higher reciprocal tariffs than Ghana, this can render Cote d'Ivoire's cocoa vulnerable to smuggling to neighboring Ghana, an unintended consequence. Africa is the future of global demand. By 2050, 25% of the world's population will be in Africa. Whilst the present trade situation is being sorted out, including a plea for the possibility of tariff exemptions for most of Africa, since this is where the largest number of least developed countries are found, 32 of the 44 least developed countries are in Africa, I have a message for the continent itself. This message is the need for more self-reliance. The external environment has changed and is more adverse. Aid is drying up and trade is becoming more politicized. So there needs to be a focus on raising domestic resources, attracting domestic, regional, and foreign investments, on faster and greater trade integration within the continent, such that intra-Africa trade is lifted well beyond the current 16%. To give an example, Africa imports an estimated $7 billion worth of textiles. There is no reason why Lesotho's $240 million worth cannot be absorbed within the continent. Africa needs to look at how it trades more within Africa and also with the rest of the world. Now, let me end with lessons. What lessons are we learning, or at least am I learning? We're learning from what is happening. The first one is over-dependence. One of the clearest lessons from the COVID-19 crisis was the importance of diversifying sources of supply. Today's trade tensions remind us that we must also diversify demand. Over-concentration, whether it's in where we buy from or where we sell to, leads to over-dependence, making economies more vulnerable to shocks and fostering a sense of unfair burden sharing. That is why I'm reiterating my call for re-globalization, to deconcentrate trade by integrating more countries and regions that have long been on the margins. The U.S. has a point when it says too many countries are dependent on its market, or that production of some critical inputs are too concentrated in certain sectors and geographies. Building global resilience requires interdependence, not over-dependence. But cultivating new source locations is not enough. It is businesses that trade, and we must be mindful of that. Businesses also need to find new markets. And this is beginning to happen. South-South trade was 10% in 1995, but is 25% of total trade now. We need to build on this development. Finally, a lesson for us at the WTO, we don't want to waste a crisis.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
In the final months of World War II, Western leaders convened the greatest economic minds of their generation. Their task, to build a new financial system. At a quiet resort high up in the mountains of New Hampshire, they laid the foundation for Pax Americana.
Speaking recently at the Institute of International Finance, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
The architects of Bretton Woods recognized that a global economy required global coordination. To encourage that coordination, they created the IMF and the World Bank. These twin institutions were born after a period of intense geopolitical and economic volatility. The purpose of the IMF and the World Bank was to better align national interests with international order, thereby bringing stability to an unstable world. In short, their purpose was to restore and preserve balance. This remains the purpose of the Bretton Woods institutions. Yet everywhere we look across the international system today, we see imbalance. The good news, it doesn't have to be this way.
Says it's time for a reset.
The Bretton Woods institutions must step back from their sprawling and unfocused agendas, which have stifled their ability to deliver on their core mandates. Going forward, the Trump administration will leverage U.S. leadership and influence at these institutions and push them to accomplish their very important mandates. The United States will also demand that the management and staffs of these institutions be accountable for demonstrating real progress. I invite all of you to join us in working to refocus these institutions on their core missions. It is in our collective interest to do so.
On the World Bank.
Like the IMF, the World Bank must be made fit for purpose again. The World Bank Group helps developing countries grow their economies, reduce poverty, increase private investment support, private sector job creation, and reduce dependence on foreign aid. It offers transparent and affordable long-term financing for countries to invest in their own development priorities. The bank, along with the fund, provides extensive technical support to promote debt sustainability among low-income countries, which empowers those countries to stand up to coercive and opaque lending terms from other creditors. These core functions of the World Bank complement the Trump administration's efforts to foster safer, stronger, and more prosperous economies in the United States and the world. But the bank, like the IMF, has strayed in certain respects from its initial mission. The bank should no longer expect blank checks for vapid, buzzword-centric marketing accompanied by half-hearted commitments to reform. As the bank returns to its core mission, it must use its resources as efficiently and effectively as possible. And it must do so in ways that demonstrate tangible values for all member countries. The bank can use its resources more efficiently now by focusing on increasing energy access. Business leaders the world over identify unreliable power supply as one of the primary impediments to investment. The World Bank and African Development Bank's joint Mission 300 initiative to expand energy access to 300 million more people in Africa is a welcome effort.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We were looking for about a 3% increase in supply, given 181 bushel yield and 94 million acres. Now we're looking at a 4% change in supply, given 95 million acres and yield the same at 181. So a 4% change in supply, what are we going to do in demand to compensate for that?
Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Grain Marketing Economist Dr. Mark Welch on supply, demand, and prices.
Well, at this point, we're looking at about a 1% increase in supply. So that leaves us a deficit of about 2%. So the typical relationship, again, if it's 4 to 5% per 1% change in supply, to see a price decline of 8 to 10% would not be surprising. And so that's USDA's number back in February, a 420 price for the season average farm price for corn in the U.S. Using those kind of numbers, my models would kick that number down with a 95, if we plant 95, and if we see demand at these levels, kick that carryover if we go from 37 days to 47 days to 52 days. You see where this is headed, a price from 435 to 420, and I've got us down to 385. By the time we get to next year. This is that relationship looks over time. There's our 40-day carryover. This is your days of use on hand at the end of the marketing year. There's your season average farm price. At the Outlook Conference, USDA landed about here. About $4.20 a bushel on a 44-day carryover. Plug in that higher corn acre number. Now we're pushing that planted, with prospective plantings report, now we're pushing that out around 50-day carryover, and we can certainly see prices sub $4. But again, that's in normal weather, the values of use that we've got built in that table. A lot of things are going to change around that. The market is certainly not trading like we're going to be at $4 corn by the time we get this fall. But I think the fundamental factors are there in place if it does start to evolve in a way that supports those kind of numbers. This thing could get weak by the time we get to next fall. Coming to real quick and to show the same thing for wheat. This is what the seasonal pattern of that December contract usually looks like. Some strength from January up till June. Then we drop and kind of consolidate around the 4th of July, around 50% level of the year's prices, price range. And then here's our fall harvest at September and October, hit a low, and then kind of a post-harvest rally. And this is our pattern over the last several weeks. Significant drop starting in early February around the Outlook Conference, trade issues becoming, I think, more of a reality, more perspective. So we've dropped that back to 440. I think it's a critical level that we hold at this point. If we get any upward momentum yet before we see maybe the season high this year, and to see if that's in. But typically we set that high before we get to the first part of July. So that's corn prices. And there's wheat. We got a bigger wheat crop globally than last year. Wheat production is higher in our major producing areas. We've got a bigger crop again, bigger crop in China, big crop coming out of India. We had a bigger crop here in the U.S., a good strength year to year, a big crop there in Australia. So we've got some major participants had a bigger crop this year. But the carryover situation globally for wheat is just like it is for corn. This is your global number for carryover, days of use on hand, at the end of the marketing year. Gold bars are outside the U.S. The black line is that global number. It has been on the decline for the last 3 or 4 years. That world global situation for wheat is relatively tight, the tightest we've been in 10 years. And so, again, a major production disruption in any of those major areas, we're setting a situation for much higher wheat prices.
That's Dr. Mark Welch, Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Grain Marketing Economist. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
A lot of times when we think about farm estate and transition planning, often our mind just goes to a will or to a trust. But there can be tactics like the one we're going to talk about today that can take place while that owner generation is living and still allow that heir to come into the operation and both sides still have a viable standard of living.
Jessica Grosskopf is an extension ag economist at the Nebraska Center for Ag Profitability.
So my hope with this series of articles is just to give folks an idea and maybe some different ideas than what their advisory teams are offering them, just to help them start those conversations and see if one of these tactics might be one that works for them.
Says there are challenges with gifting.
I think there are some challenges when we talk about straight gifting while that owner generation is still alive. And what happens with that is a lot of times someone in that owner generation doesn't want to gift an asset because, frankly, they still need that asset in order to be able to operate their business effectively. And so when we talk about combining a gift with a lease agreement, what happens is that donor gifts that asset, whether it's land, machinery, equipment, maybe even livestock, to the donee, which is usually that on-farm heir or a child. They can make that gift and then lease that gift back from the donee. So still keeping that asset basically in the business itself, providing that child with that opportunity to generate income, have some ownership, but that donor with that opportunity to still have some use of that asset, even though they no longer have control of that asset.
There are also benefits.
The biggest benefit for the donor is that they continue to have access to that asset, allowing them to maintain their standard of living. That asset is also removed from their estate. And if it's completed outside of the applicable look-back periods, it will reduce the assets counted towards long-term care and potentially estate tax. And then depending on the nature of the asset, it might also decrease that donor's property taxes. Finally, if it is a true lease agreement, that donor has the ability to deduct that rent as a business expense, potentially lowering their income tax liability. So there's a lot of benefits on the donor side. There is a risk, though, to the donor that I think really needs to be emphasized. And the fact is that they still are gifting that asset to the donee. So if that donee, and let's just imagine for a minute that that's maybe a child, if their child decides that they no longer want to lease to the donor, they don't have to, right? So it's a true lease, it's a true gift, and it's a true lease agreement. So both parties have the ability to break or terminate that lease, and that can be a challenge for the donor. If we look at the donee side, there's the benefit of receiving the asset of the gift, and then also they would receive the income from the lease, which is really important. Another thing that might be available to the donee is that if that asset was depreciable and it has depreciable value still associated with it, they might be able to depreciate that asset out as well. So there's quite a few benefits there for the donee as well. And again, it's kind of a benefit to them that if that relationship, that lease relationship isn't working, they can break the lease or terminate the lease.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, Senator, when it comes to my private sector experience, we have to remember that people engage in farming in order to make a profit and in order for them to feed their families. And the profits that they make feed the businesses and help others feed their families in rural communities. When I think of my home county of Obion County, Tennessee, it is the farmers that kind of spur all the economic development that exists there.
Stephen Vaden is nominee for Deputy Secretary of USDA.
It will allow me to keep in mind that when we're considering rules and regulations, these are going to have an effect on real people who are trying to make a living. And it is those people, their experiences, and their needs that will be first and foremost in their mind. Then, of course, as a judge, I have to keep in mind the questions that you, the Congress, statutorily charge us with answering. We have to remain faithful to the text of the law as you have passed it.